In DC.
I'm Eric, my name is Charles. And I know it's only through God's grace I'm here today clean. And it's an honor to be asked to come and share, you know, any place, you know, for any reason. I mean, it's amazing that people seem to think that I have something helpful to say, you know. I've been clean. I came to fellowship May 5th, 1980, and I haven't used from the time I found this fellowship. When I was first introduced to the fellowship, I was under a lot of court pressure. I got caught copping up on the strip, and prior to getting caught, you know, I really didn't think I had a problem. You know, I had only used for like 20 years, and I didn't think I was that bad. You know, on my way home from work, when I stopped through and got busted, and you know, I just thought that was so unfair because I knew it had been people up there all day long that they could have busted, and it really did. It just seemed so unfair that they, you know, stopped me. But prior to that day, you know, when I used to go cop, I would always have all kinds of little things that I would do so when the police jump out on me, I could get rid of the evidence. I go copping with popcorn, you know. When I cop, I stick it right up on top of the popcorn, and if I hear police, or anything, I just eat the popcorn, you know, and all kinds of ways to get rid of the evidence. But after all these years of going up there, and I've seen them jump out on somebody every time I went up there. They jump out on somebody. But after 20 years of using, you know, I had just come to the conclusion that they really didn't want me. And that I wasn't doing much wrong, you know. And I heard them that day when I got busted. They was hollering, "Chee, chee, 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 police, police." And I never even looked around. I just kept on walking out here back in my car. And that was the beginning of my recovery, you know, when they slammed me up against the car and they took me down there and they booked me for possession. I didn't realize that that was going to be the beginning, but that was the beginning of the end for me. I went home and put on a hooded jacket and went straight back up there and copped. And the same police that was up there who took me in was still up there, you know, and I figured, I didn't change nothing but the jacket. I figured that they wouldn't know it was me. But I had to go to court for that charge. And when I went to court, I took my partner with me, my half partner. And we got high when we went in the court. We got high in the court, and we were sitting in the court waiting for them to call my name. And my whole strategy was, you know, when they called me up there, you know, like he was gonna be my witnesses. In between nods, he was gonna tell these people how these police planted that stuff on me, and. I was going to get off. It was going to be my word. I had my guy, you know, it was going to be me and him against the two police, you know. Our word against theirs, you know. And I believed that was going to work. I mean, that's all I had. And so I went to court for a whole year on that. And every time I would go to court, I wouldn't have a lawyer. Because, I had a lawyer, but I wouldn't pay him. And he would be in the court, but he would try not to represent me. And the judge said, "Well, Mr. Watson, where's your lawyer?" You know, and I would point him out. I said, "There he is over there." And he would say, "Come on up." They'd make him come up, and he would say, "Well, you know, you have to represent him." He said, "Your Honor, this guy, he hasn't paid me." And the judge would always say, "Well, you represent him today." And that's how my court thing went. People would give me money to pay my lawyer, but I would never give it to him. You know, I couldn't release the money. If you wanted to pay something for me, you needed to just pay the bill or give somebody else. But I couldn't take the money and pay it, you know, because that's the way I use. And when I went to court that last time, they said, "Mr. Washington, you have anything to say before we impose sentence?" Because they had told me the last time, they said, "Mr. Washington, the next time you come, we're going to sentence you with or without a lawyer." And I went there again. I still didn't have a lawyer. And let me just say this. This is the miracle that happened. I believe it. I recognize it now, you know. Like, the trial that was ahead of mine went on a little longer than I expected, you know. And we had the recess, court recess for lunch. And I went out, and they had groups, spiritual groups, churches from every state in the United States, and they were marching down near the courthouse. And I prayed with as many groups as I could that day, you know, and I just said, God, help me. I said, you know, my situation better than I do. I just need some help. Because there wasn't nothing I can do. I knew my strategy wasn't working in court, you know. And when I went back in that court, the judge said, you have anything to say before imposed sentence? And I told him, I said, yes, Your Honor. I said, Your Honor, I know how to live in jail. So if you could sentence me to some kind of program that can help me learn how to live on the street, I said, I know I'll be better off, you know. And then I told him about this program that somebody told me about in one of the oil joints that I was in. And he let me go to that program. He gave me enough time. I told him, I said, it's going to take like 45 days. I have to have at least 45 days before my next court date or they won't accept me. So they gave me plenty of time, you know, some extra days, you know, to do that. And when I left out the courtroom, I left out laughing and smiling, and I was like, man, I got over. You know, he bought it, the lie. You know, the lie was that, you know, I knew how to live in jail and I needed to learn how to live on the street. But that was the truth. I didn't realize that until after I got in the treatment. And I waited till the last minute to go into treatment. Then I went up there begging them, you know, because I said, well, I got to get in now because, I got to be in before the 45 days. I wasted time. And that was the beginning of my recovery when I went to that program and I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous. And in that program, it was a great program, but they didn't have liquor stores on the corner in that building, and they didn't have dealers stopping me from getting to my meetings, offering me stuff. So it wasn't hard to stay clean in there. It was a six-month program. I stayed there 6 months. And when I got out, I knew some things to do. I went to a meeting first. I changed my residence. I went to an Oxford house and began to go to meetings every day. I went straight to a meeting. When I got out of treatment, the first thing I did was I went straight to a meeting. And I let everybody know, look, I just got out of treatment today. I said, if I don't get some help, I'm going to use. And at the end of the meeting, three or four of my friends, I didn't know they were my friends at the time, took me to my Oxford house, got me settled in, and they waited for me to get everything. And when I got finished there, they took me to a meeting, and we hung up all that day. We hung out going to meetings and talking. And the next day, they told me where to meet them at, and we did that. When I came into fellowship, it was only three meetings in the Washington, Baltimore area. Wasn't very many meetings. And we went to, you know, we began to start a lot of meetings and stuff. We began to try to build the meetings in our area because I had to go to a lot of the other fellowship meetings to get started, and they were very tolerant of us. Because, I mean, we in there, we was talking some stuff that made people with, you know, like 15, 20 years, we make them uncomfortable because we were in there talking about popping pills, and some of them may have still been doing that, but they wasn't drinking. It was a exclusive fellowship, you know, it was exclusive fellowship, you know. They was only concerned with the one drug, and as long as they wasn't doing that, they was okay, and they had their sobriety intact. They had everything, you know. But, you know, when we go in there, we're talking about, you know, like I'm having troubles with the prescription drugs, and we make people feel uncomfortable in their place of refuge, you know. But they were tolerant of us, and they helped us start some meetings. In other words, they was sort of putting us out nicely, you know, and that helped us to begin to, you know, start a lot of meetings. And, you know, I would meet my sponsor in the meeting because I was one that every time I go to the meeting, y'all would confuse me. Now, I listen to y'all, because we were real cool then. I mean, we didn't just have a straightforward message. We were so slick and so cool that after y'all finished talking, I needed an interpreter, you know. What were they talking about in there? I knew y'all were talking about not using, but, you know, like I had it. After we leave the meeting, I'd ask my sponsor, I said, what the drop the rock mean? What that mean? what do the images must go and all those stuff. I mean, it's cool to say those things, but then you might want to explain what it is you're talking about, you know, because there are going to be some people that don't know. Then he was talking about, you know, like you just got to, you know, like drop the rock. You got to stop, you know, just let that stuff go that you're doing, you know, like stop holding on to some stuff that's not good, you know, and, you know, like just open yourself up for a new way of life. I did about 95% of everything that was suggested in the program. The other 5% had a lot to do with women and relationships. You know, and that's where that other 5% came in. And I didn't have no problem with that, and there wasn't nothing, you know, a whole lot y'all could tell me about that. So, but I mean, you know, I did everything they say. You know, I got a home group and went to meetings every day. I talked to my sponsor every day. I tried to meet him at meetings because, like I said, I needed an interpreter. And he could, you know, like encourage me and help me stop being so hard on myself. You know, I didn't think I was going to get this. I didn't even realize that I already came out of treatment. I had 6 months clean. You know, it didn't seem like I, you know, had 6 months clean. I went to that same convention that the other speaker was talking about in New York. And I'm sure I must have met Jimmy because I was there, you know, but I was convinced that that was my first convention when I went up there. One of the guys that I sponsored told me, he said, "Nah, this ain't your first convention." I said, "Nah," I was excited. You know, I was like, shoot, we're going to convention, my first convention. I was sponsoring people that, you know, I guess they wasn't as bad as me because they were doing a lot better off than me, you know. They could remember a whole lot more than me. That's how I know there's a God, you know, because I was helping them. And they told me about the conventions that we put on. We had put on conventions. He said, "Remember we did this thing up at the University of Maryland?" And I started explaining everything. I said, "Yeah." He said, "That was a convention." Okay, you know. Because I just got caught up in this thing, man. I was just doing whatever y'all were doing, and I was caught up, you know, like the titles and all that stuff didn't mean a whole lot to me. You know, I was just playing it safe. You know, I like I said, I went to meetings every day, 2 and 3 meetings a day for 5 years before I missed my first meeting. I had a motorcycle accident, and I was in the hospital. And I didn't miss many meetings while I was in that hospital because the facility that we had, the hospital that I was in, had an NA meeting. And they would roll my whole bed down to the meeting. So, I mean, I didn't miss a whole lot of meetings. Whenever there was a meeting in that hospital, I made it. And I got involved with the helpline because I had plenty of time to talk on the phone there, you know. And they were talking about cutting my legs off, that, you know, I may never walk again. And while I was in that hospital, I learned a lot about forgiveness and faith. You know, I had to forgive the guy that hit me when I was on that bike because he didn't come out the house and planned to, you know, ruin my life. And I had to forgive him so that I can go on with my life. My lawyer kept telling me that, "Oh, you ought to be able to get like $350,000 for this accident." Well, the guy had $20,000 worth of insurance. Now, I could have held on to that and said, "Well, you know, like I'll just go on and I'll sue him, and you, if you ever get any money, you know, I'll get it." But see, I would still probably be bitter now if I had done that, you know, because he may not have gotten that kind of money even now. So I have forgave him. And I began to help other people and direct them into the fellowship, which made me feel good when I finally got home because some of the guys that I talked to on the phone was like, "Yeah, I talked to you and you sent me to this." You know, I was able to continue to see people grow and get better in this fellowship. I enjoyed doing that today. You know, I enjoy seeing the newcomer, talking to them, and then watch them grow up in this fellowship, you know, make something out of their life, pull their family back together, and smiling, and you know, all those things that we didn't do before we got here. You know, I enjoy it. And the reason why I'm here today is because I know that I still suffer with the same disease that put me in a situation where I had to do such a desperate thing as come here, you know, still exists in my life today. That if I forget, you know, I'm doomed to repeat everything that got me here. You know, I live good today. You know, my life, I mean, is a lot better than I ever could have, you know, planned for myself. And I could easily forget that I got a problem because I look so normal. you know, I talk to people, you know, and the people that are not a part of this fellowship, and if I have the opportunity to share some things about my life with them, they don't believe it. You know, they can't even understand how I can sit up there and tell those kind of lies and try to convince them of the kind, I mean, you know, the kind of guy I was and those kind of things. So, I mean, I obviously look normal. But see, y'all, when I come in here and I listen to y'all share, and we're more alike than we are different, those people that I think, they look pretty normal. I mean, I was around when the women started coming in. I said, she must have been hooked on steroids. Because they don't look like they lost a whole lot, you know. Some of them don't look too beat up, you know. Because when I came in, I mean, you know, like they would shoot dope in the top and it would fall out the bottom of their arm. Man, we came in beat up. The people that came in with me, we were ruined, you know. And so I look a little normal. But I know that I'm not, you know. I have to come in here and I still have to do the things that I did to get here. Next week I'll be celebrating my 25th year. In my home group. But that's not so impressive because I, you know, like in my early recovery, I've almost always had, you know, like most of the time in a lot of meetings that I go to, but I've been impressed with the people that come after me, you know, the ones who knew they had a serious problem and began to work real hard in the beginning because they made good examples for me. That, I mean, you know, because if they could do so much with their life and get their life together, then I could do the same. I mean, I think, you know, like how much better I would be now if I had started earlier just being real serious about this, you know. I did, like I said, I still, you know, for the wrong reasons did 90% of everything that was suggested. When I came in, they used to say stuff like, you got to change people, places, and things. I'm sure they still say some of that today. And they said that, you know, like you have to change jobs. I don't know if they're saying that now. Jobs are hard to find, but they told me, said, you have to change jobs, you know, because for 8 hours a day, you're going to be the same person, you know, you're going to go through all the same emotions, and if you shot dope every day at 12 o'clock, when it'll start approaching 12 o'clock, you're going to want to use and this and that, you know, and I believe them, so I changed jobs, took a therapeutic job, you know, making minimum wage with $3.75 or whatever it was. I learned that $3.75 an hour is a lot of money if you're not shooting dope. That was a lot of money, you know, because with that money, I was able to get me an apartment. I was able to start a checking account, a savings account. You know, I had a car, a truck, and 2 motorcycles at the end of, you know, like 2 years. And, you know, and it was with minimum wage, you know. You can't buy nothing with one paycheck. But, I mean, you know, if you save your money, you can get anything you want to, you know. I wasn't messing it up. Let me talk about, you know, the things that I had to go through with a sponsor, because I came here, like I said, I was worse than most of y'all because I didn't realize I had a problem. I didn't think, you know, I didn't think it was fair for them to have to, you know, like lock me up and take me through all those changes, you know, when my life wasn't that bad, you know. I mean, I was living with my mother and she was gassing up my car and washing my clothes and feed me and all that stuff, but I mean, I wasn't that bad, you know. And but I was on my way back to jail for the first 4 years in the fellowship. I was paranoid about going to jail. I was like, so you know, like I didn't mention that my first sponsor was a lawyer, did I? I picked him because I was gonna need one. I was gonna need a lawyer, you know, so. So, but I mean, everything bothered me, you know, like, because I started using at the age of 9 years old. When I found the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, I was 31 years old. So, I mean, I pretty much grew up in the streets, you know, and all I knew was that foolishness, you know, and I had made decisions at the age of 8, you know, that I was going to, you know, take the drink and live that life, you know, and I just wasn't going to stop, you know. I enjoyed what I was doing. Even when I came to fellowship, I enjoyed the lifestyle. I enjoyed being around all that excitement and stuff like that, just living right up on the edge. You know, so I had to, you know, I had to learn some new stuff. You know, I had to you know, I remember one time I called my sponsor, you know, we sit down and talk for a long time because I was messed up. My life was getting really messed up, you know, and I couldn't understand what was going on. I hadn't used, but we talked, and I explained to him everything that was going on. And when I get finished, he said, yeah, I understand. He said, what it is, you're getting comfortable. And I said, no, it's not that. I think, wait a minute, let me start all over again, you know. So I began to explain again, you know, because he had missed something, you know. And I explained everything and told him what was going on and what was happening and everything. He said, that's it, you're just getting comfortable. He said, but you're not used to being comfortable. That's what it is, you know. See, my life has started, I started experiencing an absence of turmoil, you know, and it wasn't comfortable to me. You know, I'm used to something going on all the time, you know, and wasn't nothing happening, you know. So I was comfortable. He said, it just don't feel comfortable. You don't know what comfortable is, really. I didn't know. So, so I'm getting comfortable. I had to learn how to be comfortable, you know. I had to learn how to be able to go home and sit down and read and feed myself and just relax and take a bath, you know. So, I mean, it was years. I had an apartment, but I wouldn't go there. You know, I couldn't be in the house by myself. You know, I had to learn how to do that. And I began to do that when I started writing out my steps, you know, because I had to set aside some time. And it was during meeting time that I began to write my steps, because I used meetings as an excuse not to do the step work. I told my sponsor, I go to way too many meetings to be writing out some steps. You know, I'm going to 2 or 3 meetings a day. I told you I went to 2 or 3 meetings a day for like 3.5 years before I cut back to like 1. And I was clean 5 years before I missed my first meeting. But I told him, I said, I explained to him, here's my day. I go to work. When I get off, I go to this meeting. When I get off, I go to that meeting. When I finish, it's almost 11 o'clock. You know, I go to bed. I got to go to work in the morning, you know. So he said, well, just take a day. I said, but I got to go to meetings. You know, I need to go to a meeting every day. He said, just take a day, whatever day you want, and you just sit there and you set aside that time to write your step up. So that's how I get it. I would take it Monday, and I would sit there, and I wouldn't write. You know, I would just sit there. Then I'd get on the phone. I'd call every one of y'all, and y'all wouldn't be home. Y'all were in the meetings, you know. And at some point, you know, I began to pray and write out that stuff. And the only reason I did some work in terms of the steps was because, one, you know, I wanted to sponsor people. Like I told you, I didn't think I had no problems, you know, but my sponsor told me that if I'm going to have to, you know, help somebody and walk through the steps, then I've had to have a knowledge of them. So I started doing that so that I can help y'all. Because, I mean, it was, y'all was sick. I'm going to tell you, I went to the meeting. Went to the meeting with my sponsor. We leave out, when we got out the door, I was just laughing. I was cracking up, you know. And I told him, I said, man, it's some sick mothers, so-and-so's in there, you know. And I mean, you know, I was just broke up because that was a good meeting. And he said, yeah, I know. We just came out, you know. And he would always put me in the frame of mind that I'm a part of this stuff, you know, that I'm a part of what makes NA what it is, you know. And even though, you know, couldn't get honest with just where I was in my personal life, you know, some people could. And it was through your honest reflection that I was able to take a look at myself, you know, because when I heard you share, I could identify with what y'all were going through. And even in my denial, I realized I was doing those same things that everybody else seemed to have a problem doing, you know, because I mean, most things that I was doing that y'all were complaining about, I wasn't having problems yet, you know, so it didn't make sense to, you know, do something about that when it comes to relationships and all that other stuff. But after 2 years, that's when I began to, like, write out the steps and do something with my life. And my life has never been the same since. As a result of living this program and developing some character and learning how to work through some things, you know, like, my life got better. I want to share about how, you know, like, how I got involved with H&I. Because I was always, like I told you, for the first 4 years, I was worried that I was going to jail, you know. And I was always, when I shared in the meeting, I said, you know, like, you know, it's just a matter of time. You know, I'd never been out of the street more than 4 years. My life has always been in and out of jail, you know. And I went over my limit, right? So I was in there. I was like, man, it's just a matter of time, you know. Like, I'm not going to be here much longer because, you know, they're going to, you know, they're going to find out where I'm at. Well, I got this certified letter, right? I got this certified letter. The yellow slip come in the mail, and when I saw it, I panicked, you know. I was like, oh, shit. They know where I live at, you know. So I called my sponsor. I said, man, they got me, man. They got me. You know, I'm going to jail, man. You know, they got me. He said, well, what's the matter? I said, they know where I live at, man. They just sent me the stuff. You know, I got this. He said, calm down. Explain what's happening. I said, they sent me the thing in the mail. I got the yellow slip. I'm getting agitated now, right? You know, and they know where I live at, you know, and it's a certified mail. He said, well, what the letter say? I said, I don't know. I ain't go down there. I don't know what the letter say. He said, why don't you get the letter? Why don't you get the letter? You read it and then call me back. You know. But that was a big lesson for me, you know. And when I got it, it didn't have nothing to do with me going to jail or nothing like that. They send you certified letters because they want to know that you received whatever notice that they sent you, you know. But every time I've ever got one, they was like something about going to jail, you know. So I was beginning to learn some things. I talked to my sponsor, and what I learned that day is that, you know, I don't have to worry about nothing, you know, because I worry about too much stuff, you know. I worry about my rent being due at the end of the month. I pay the rent today. Tomorrow, the worry starts, you know. Where am I going to get the money to pay the rent? You know, I don't have enough in my checking account to pay it and stuff like that. But when I talked to my sponsor, he would say, well, don't you get paid 4 more times before then, you know. And that kind of stuff. So he taught me not to worry. He said, you know what? He said, there's plenty of time to worry. And now is just not the time. And I try to live that today. You know, I don't have to worry about stuff. He told me, he said, you're going to worry about something that's happening next week all day long. He said, and if you die tonight, you'd have wasted your last day on earth worrying about a day that you would never live to see. And so I took that to heart, you know. I was like, okay, you know, like now's not the time to worry, because so much stuff happens, you know, that when we get to that time, that particular time in our life that we need something to be happening, it'll happen, you know. So I don't worry too much about that. Not too much about it. You know, I'm concerned about my life, but I don't worry that much. And I was beginning to learn how to deal with life on life terms, you know, because stuff happens. So then, you know, when it came to me worrying about going to jail with that letter and stuff, he said, I'm going to tell you, he said, you worry so much about going to jail. He said, we're going to have to get you in there now, you know, so when you can get out the same day. So I got involved with H&I, you know, so he would take me in the institution so I can be released the same day, you know. And I spent 3 years going back and forth to Lorton, you know, and I think that really helped calm me down, because when I get in there, man, when you're in the institution, they got good information in there. All those guys can tell you just what to do to stay out. They can tell you just what to do, and I listen to them share, you know, and like when I leave out there, I know I got to do the things that they were talking about doing. But the problem is, you know, like when they come out, it's a little harder to do. You know, God jump-started my life, you know, because of that prayer that I prayed. God gave me an opportunity to do something about my life. You know, I couldn't have stopped on my own. I don't think no one person in this room could have said anything to me to make me stop using, you know. But somehow or another, through God's grace and his mercy and my sincere prayer and all the prayers that was prayed by my mother and my grandmother and all those people that cared about me, at some point I was blessed. You know, and the compulsion to use was gone. See, when I was using, I couldn't stop. Even when I wanted to stop, if I stopped for 3 days, you know, I thought I was clean. Yeah, after 3 days, you know, I was like, I'd go out there and then my chest be out there. I mean, I'm miserable for the 3 days. I was like, you know, like going through withdrawals and feeling real bad. But 3 days was the golden number. Once I got 3 days, I come right on out the house, telling everybody, man, you know, I kicked that stuff, you know. I knew I could do it, you know. I may have been drinking the whole time that I was kicking, you know what I'm saying? But I come out there, I'm talking about, I knew I can do it, you know, and before that day is out, I'm using again, you know. So I know that, you know, getting clean was a difficult thing, you know, and the fact that I had been clean for a few years let me know that it was a power working in my life. And first three steps, you know, was introducing me to that power and giving me some ideas of how to go about using that power. And through talking with people in my network and people in general that's recovery minded, let me know that that was a powerful power that I can use for other areas of my life. You know, so I've learned how to use that power in every area of my life, you know. I mean, it blesses my family because of the blessing that's on my life. It blesses my marriage. It blesses the relationship with my kids. And I'm blessed on the job. You know, all kinds of good things have happened as a result of me just not using. My first employee hired me out of treatment because they was giving up a tax break. I was in treatment, you know, and I worked for some real nice Jewish people who wanted tax break. So they hired me. And I went down there and I told them, I said, y'all gonna have to watch me. I was working in the furniture store. I said, y'all gotta watch me, you know, because I steal. You know? Y'all had taught me how to be honest. I'm telling you, I was in treatment for 6 months, so I knew a little bit about being honest, you know. I said, y'all gonna have to watch me, you know, because I steal. You know, so they kept me, you know, and they watched me, you know. They watched me. Then every day at noontime, they'd be like, isn't it time for your classes? You know, because we had a meeting right around the corner, you know, so every day at noontime, they would get me out there to my classes, right? You know, so. And I'd come back in and I would do it, you know. I would just, and I kept that job for a lot of years, you know. And that job, they taught me a lot on that job. Like I said, it taught me that minimum wage is a lot of money. I learned that. And I've learned how to live within my means, you know. I had the means to live a lot bigger than I live today. But, you know, that wouldn't mean that I'm living in my means just because I got the money to afford me with that type of lifestyle when there are other more important things going on in my life, you know. So I don't have to really flaunt, you know, my finances, you know. I don't have to flaunt that, you know, because, I mean, once I start doing that, it's just a matter of time before y'all see just how bad I really am doing, you know. But they learned to trust me. At some point, I ended up with the keys to the store. But that didn't stop me from stealing. I stole from them after about 5 years clean or something like that. And I saw something that I wanted real bad in that store, you know, and then, you know, so I just took it. At the end of the day, we was all getting ready to leave. It's seven brothers, you know, and when we get ready to leave, I grabbed the pot. It was a big old, some kind of urn. It was beautiful, right? And I picked it up, and we started walking to the door. When I got to the door, I gave it to my boss. I bent over, and I locked the doors up. You know, he gave it back to me, and then we go out to our car, put it in the car, and I went home. Because that's how I used to steal, right? You know, I just steal openly, you know. So, but all weekend, I was like, man, you know, I'm going to get busted, man, you know. I know they all was thinking somebody else said take it, you know, because it's seven brothers. And it was like, all weekend, man, I couldn't wait, man. I was messed up, man. I mean, I felt like I had shot some dope. Then I had some water shots and some other stuff, right? You know, it was a bunch of bad stuff going on that weekend, man, you know. And I couldn't wait till Monday, you know. And then Monday morning, I snuck it back in there, you know. And then I realized, man, I can't do the stuff I used to do, man, you know. And that stuff just don't sit well with me no more. You know, I was so glad when I got it back, you know, and then I come up with all the lies that I was going to tell them when they asked me about it, you know. But they trusted me enough. If I told them, I just wanted to see how it looked in my house, you know. They would have believed me, you know. But those same people talked me into buying my first house. And they hound me and pressured me every day. Did you get your VA eligibility? You know. Day after day, I got tired of them saying that, so I picked it up on the way to work one day. I see, I got it. Then they start saying, well, now you can start looking for a house. And every day, you looking for a house, you looking for a house, you looking for a house. So I started looking for a house. Just everything I did was just shut them up. And when after I, you know, started looking for a house, did you find a house? Did you find a house? Did you find a house? When I found a house, I said, now they're going to have to leave me alone. Because the people told me I need some money to buy this house, you know. And I found a house. So did you find a house? I said, yeah, I found a house. But I'm going to need X amount of dollars to get in, and I don't have it. And my boss said, well, let me talk to my wife, and I'll let you know something tomorrow. And the next day, he gave me a check for the amount that I said I need. And those people, they bought me that house, told me, said, don't worry about paying me back until you get at least 3 months worth of bill money in your account. Once you saved up enough money to pay all your bills for 3 months, then you could start trying to pay me back. And they gave me a raise because I wasn't making enough money to pay my bills. And they filled the house up with furniture because I needed furniture. They were a furniture store, right? And he told me, he said, you know, if I had a son, I would want him to be just like you, you know. And see, you know, that come from just years of, you know, like really paying attention to my own life. You know, I gotten to the point I wasn't a nice guy. I wasn't as nice as I appear to be today, you know. I'm not that nice now, but my appearance, my appearance is a lot better, you know. But, I was not a nice guy, you know. And for me to, you know, like develop into something that anybody could see something nice in, you know, I was sort of impressed with the way my life was coming along. You know, when it came to women, like I told you, I didn't have any cut cards when it came to women, and I didn't think I need to do no work in that area. You know, but it reached a point when, you know, like I was concerned, you know, and I talked to my spouse and I said, you know what, I'm never going to have a decent relationship with a woman. And he said, why is that? I said, because, you know, I said, you know, I have their interest at heart. You know, I really want to help them. You know, I said, but after 2 hours of trying to help them, I want to do something else. You know, and I see that this is going to be a problem. You know, it's really going to be a problem. And he told me, he said, man, that ain't no problem. You know, he said, when you stop wanting to do that, then you call me because you got a problem. He said, you're a man. He said, it's normal to want to do those kind of things, you know, but you don't have to act on them. I said, but I'm never going to have a woman in my life, that, you know, that we can have a meaningful relationship. And he assured me that if, you know, he said, if you work these steps, you can develop yourself into the kind, now, first of all, he asked, he said, what kind of woman do you like? You know, so I started describing her. She probably sounds something like Halle Berry or something like that with a nice job, you know, and, you know, real political person. And he said, she won't like you. That's what he told me. He said, she won't like you. The woman that I wanted wouldn't like me. And but he said, he guaranteed me that if I could work these steps and develop some principles to live by, that I could, you know, develop myself into the type of person that could attract that very woman and keep her, you know. And that's what he told me. And that's come true, you know, because I'll be celebrating my 10th year of marriage this June and July. See, I had to remember my brother's birthday to come up with that, you know. But I'm enjoying being married. You know, I enjoy it. I've learned how to enjoy it. You know, and the way I enjoy my marriage is by not creating problems. The same thing I do in every other area of my life. The only time I have problems is when I manufacture them. You know, nothing going wrong in my life. You know, everything that seems bad ain't bad. You know, but if I get involved with and start manufacturing stuff on my own or start trying to take care of things that I perceive as wrong in my life, I'm in for trouble, you know, because nothing is that bad in my life. And I hope I help somebody, because y'all certainly helped me by just allowing me to come out and be a part of, you know, Staying Clean One Day. And I want to thank everybody who had a part in inviting me up here and turn the meeting back over. Thank you.